I'm often accused of being a dreamer, but what people sometimes don't recognize is the dedication and perseverance it took to make my dreams reality.
Howard Baldwin started as a minor league ticket counter and steadily worked his way up, eventually becoming a founding owner in the World Hockey Association, or WHA. Known as the Rebel League, the WHA was responsible for forcing the NHL out of its medieval stupor. In time, the two leagues would come together. Howard would play a crucial role in overseeing that merger in ending hockey's seven-year war. But during those 7 years, the League of the Outlaws put out seven great seasons of hockey. Among the teams, none would match the sustained success of Howard's. Essentially born out of a bluff, his New England Whalers were crowned WHA champions in the league's inaugural season. The Avco World Trophy would be far from the last piece of championship hardware Howard hoisted above his head. But now we're getting ahead of ourselves, because the path to that historic night in 1973, the entire path Howard took, was anything but straightforward. Nothing would ever be given. Everything would have to be earned. And he knew it, too. It's a journey that's hard to believe, especially considering that just months prior to the puck dropping on that first season, the Whalers were nothing more than an idea. A dream. At the time, one of Boston's leading sports columnists wrote that the chances of the 20-something-year-old successfully establishing a WHA team in New England were, quote, slim and none. After all, founding a professional hockey franchise requires an arena, players, and money. Howard had none of the three. But he had ambition. He wasn't afraid to dream.
To be accused of being a dreamer really isn't such a bad thing, so long as you're willing to work hard, to persevere. This is the story of what it took to make my dreams come true.
Hi, I'm Stephen Maggi. Welcome to this edition of Slim and None. A kind of a new feature here, a new format we're introducing to you. Howard Baldwin tells the story of what he went through and really takes you by the hand to take this trip with him, to go back in time and look at what was really a somewhat chaotic situation, but also a situation which brought real success and led to a merger with the National Hockey League. Last week, we spoke about trying to find an arena and all the things that went along with that. Well, today, we're going to talk about building a team, which is really crucial, which will lead into the draft, which we will cover next week. So, Howard, okay, you've got the arena now. Not exactly what you wanted. You've got a name for the team, the New England Whalers. How did all that come about? And as you're thinking about building that team, what are the first things that come into your mind?
First of all, I don't know that we ever spent enough time on talking about the selection of the name New England Whalers. And perhaps we talk a little about that.
Yeah, let's do that.
What happened is we had a long list of names. And in fact, I even have the original list that has about 60 names on it. We all went down the list of names and sent them to Jack and Ginny Kelly and sort of our inside group. And really and truly, Ginny Kelly, Jack's wife, was the one that circled the name Whalers and sent that back and said, this is the name. This is the best. And right away, we all looked at each other and said, she's right. This is a terrific name, and it's synonymous with the area in which we were all living in, and so that is how the team got its name. Really, Ginny Kelly, we feel she'd get the credit for that. The colors were a little easier to select. We loved the sort of the Celtics colors, and there were no colors, green and white, in all of hockey anywhere at that particular time. I guess the Minnesota North Stars were the closest one. So we went right for those colors. And they were synonymous with championships because the Celtics was a championship team. And then oddly and coincidentally enough, although this had nothing to do with it, a year later our partner bought the Celtics. Bob Schmertz actually bought the Celtics. So that worked out well as well.
Now, you know, those colors like that, was merchandising in the back of your mind as well? Because there were so few teams that had them, and I think people were drawn to them.
You're 100% right. And merchandising, you know, it's interesting because in those days, merchandising was not a big deal. It became a big deal over the next 5 or 10 years. But it really wasn't. Everything was in the tickets, the tickets. You didn't even have luxury boxes then. You didn't have club seats then. And your television was very, very limited. We like the idea of that color because you're right. In hockey, there were very few green and white. So that worked well. But for revenues, you know, a little fun story, not to go off down another trail, but the HBO was just starting in 1972. Everybody's heard of HBO. Well, when it started by Chuck Dolan, who was a genius, his son owns the Garden, the Rangers, and Knicks, Jimmy Dolan. But Chuck had HBO, and we reached out to each other somehow, and the Whalers were the first ever game on HBO. We had, I believe it was 6 games on HBO, and we got a total of 6 grand. So how's that?
Let's talk about the name New England. I thought that was great because, like the Patriots, you went from being just strictly a Boston team to a regional team, which had to be when you're trying to establish a name for yourself. That gave you a lot of possibilities, not only in Boston, but around all of New England.
You couldn't be more right. We wanted to appeal to all of New England. And in fact, when we get to the philosophy of building the team, that'll come into play. But there's really, other than in Providence, which we talked about a little earlier, there's no other arena in New England of major league status. Hartford wasn't there yet, nothing in Portland, nothing in Worcester, and Providence was just getting theirs built at 10 or 11,000 seats. So the arena and the sport in Boston, that was that. So we wanted to differentiate ourselves from the Bruins, and frankly, the Celtics and the Red Sox, and really reach out to all of New England. And that's why we called New England Whalers.
Was that something, too, you were thinking of at a time? Because those are all great sports franchises with long histories. Were you thinking, though, like, wow, we have to do something to get our name there, or it would be easy to fall into a secondary category if you don't market it correctly?
We had to establish an identity, and that's part of it. We had to do anything and everything we could to set ourselves apart. We had a lot going against us. There was no question about that. So the more we could do to get attention and to sort of stand out, like, I hate to use the word sore thumb, but a nice juicy thumb or whatever, we had to do things differently and brand ourselves differently. And I think we did that.
Well, let's talk about, first of all, establishing the team within the WHA, and there's some $250,000 franchise fee that you guys didn't want to pay. Tell the story, please.
Well, we know if we go back to the November meeting at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami, the price went from $25,000 to $250,000. And we know that we just said, sure, we'll agree to the $250,000. A, we didn't have it anyway. And B, we figured that would be tomorrow's problem, which they made clear. We didn't have to pay the $250,000 right away. We could pay it within a certain period of time. So when we did the deal with Bob Schmertz, which we discussed earlier, and one of the things Bob said is, well, why are you guys paying $250,000 when the guys that got in 3 weeks before paid $25,000? And we said that was just another version of, quote-unquote, holding us up. He said, well, boys, he says, we ain't paying that, is what he said. And I said, it's fine with us. Well, you tell us how you want to proceed. So one of the very early key meetings, probably was the most key meeting other than, and we hadn't had many, but over the history, that first meeting in Quebec in February was key because it really was the first meeting that pulled everybody together, all 12 franchises, the league office, et cetera, at the Chateau Frontenac in Quebec, great old hotel, great place, had a lot of meetings there. And Bob Schmertz said, look, I'm going to fly up to the meeting to help you guys out, and I'm only going to, he had a private jet, and he said, I'll come to the meeting and do my thing and get out. And we were very grateful and appreciative. And so we get to the meeting. It was a wild meeting. It really was. It was like a 3 or 4 day meeting, everybody sizing each other up, everybody politicizing behind the scenes. It was my first real education on what league meetings are, which is everybody being in a room together and acting as if they're all partners. And then as soon as you leave the room, you say, well, now, what about this guy? We start talking about each other behind their back. So it was an education given to me very quickly. But we all got it. Believe me, we got the drill. We also got the fact that because of Bob Schmertz, we were probably the most well-financed team in the league. You could see quickly, as inexperienced as we were, that many of these franchises were looking like what I would have to define as shadow franchises or potentially ghost franchises, and were held together with a little bit of BS, et cetera, et cetera. So we somehow felt that if Bob took this hard position, they were not going to throw us out of the league. So the meeting got underway, and one of the first items on the agenda, and they knew it was coming, by the way, but one of the first items on the agenda was the $225,000, and Schmertz stood up and said, look, there's absolutely no reason why we should pay this. Nothing goes up in value in 3 weeks by $25,000 to $250,000, and we've had a chance to become a little more familiar with the way other people are financed. And so if you want us to remain in the league, we want to remain in the league, but we're not paying it. The way it was really resolved was that there were a couple of Canadian owners that were a little more difficult, like a guy like Bill Hunter, who loves to hear the sound of his own voice. And they said, well, this isn't right, blah, blah, blah. But their way of dealing with it was, well, we'll defer it down the road, which we knew right away was mean. It was going to go away. So that's what happened. When Bob left, we looked at each other and we said to him, Bob, well done. We'll never have to pay this. And of course, we never did. And the rest of the meeting was fine. There were some incredible, you know, you start meeting people, some of whom, you know, we knew about either through the paper or through the memos that were going back and forth, and some of whom we had no idea who the heck they were. I mean, one fun, really fun story is, you know, this was a group that liked to party. And I remember standing in the men's room next to a guy named Glenn Somner, who's just a great guy. And he was the GM of the St. Paul Fighting Saints, working for a guy named Irv Kaplan. And he was a little bit under the weather, shall we say, but I'm sure I probably was too. But the next thing I heard was an expletive deleted, and oh my God, and I heard a plunk. And I looked at him and I saw, my God, he's missing his eye. And I said, are you all right? He said, yeah. He said, sometimes my eye pops out. And it dropped out, and of course it dropped out into the urinal. So that was my introduction to Glenn Somner, and the meeting sort of went sideways from there. But we got through it. We came out of there 225 better off in the wallet, and got a good feel for all the other teams and all the other owners. And when we left, we said, okay, we have a league, but this is going to be one very interesting ride. And that it was.
Just talk a little, if you will, kind of give us the feel of the different owners. I mean, in the book, you say Bill Hunter, the owner from Edmonton, was sort of like P.T. Barnum. And I completely get that. Did you have the whole gamut where some were real conservative and didn't like to spend a cent? Other people were kind of crazy and saw this as their opportunity to be a big sports owner?
Yeah, I think they all saw the opportunity to be something that they weren't in their local marketplace. And, you know, like the Canadian guys, Benny Haskins, who ended up being such a dear and close friend and was a pillar of strength in the league. He was from Winnipeg, okay? Now, he was a gruff guy, played in the Canadian Football League, really rough and tough, gruff guy, who looked at me and Kobe, and when I say he had utter disdain for us, he just said, who are these spoiled brats at 28 or 29 coming in and trying to compete with me? But over the year, we quickly got a ton of affection and respect for each other. But we knew Benny was well-financed. Hunter was a true P.T. Barnum. He had more to say than anybody. He stood up and gave speeches and proclamations. And I must say, we were I mean, Coburn and I spent half the meetings just laughing at some of this stuff that was going on. But Hunter, in his own way, was good for the league because he got the league attention. He said the most absurd, outrageous things, but somehow it was effective part of the time. And we heard everybody said to us early on, now you watch Bill. He does this with his junior team. The first season, midway through the season, maybe two-thirds of the way through, he'll get unhappy with the coach. He'll fire the coach and he'll coach. I said, you mean an owner is going to coach you? That's what he's going to do. And sure enough, 3 years in a row, that's what he did. He was a character. Paul Deneau was, I mean, gosh, I hate to say that about anybody, that he was just not our kettle of fish. But he was another rough guy, a rough guy. He had the team in Dayton, and he couldn't get the arena the way he wanted. So they moved to Houston, which was a great thing. And he had enough sense to hire a fellow named Bill Dineen, who ended up working for us, coaching for us. His son, Kevin, played for us, and to this day is a friend. He was a good owner in that he did good things for the franchise. I'm going to give him that. And we had franchise moves very early on. I mean, it was at that February meeting where San Francisco, which was owned by Gary Davidson, went to Quebec. Well, that was huge for the league. The Quebec ownership and the Quebec franchise ended up being a pillar of strength for the league. The Calgary franchise went to Cleveland a couple of months later. That was Nick Mulledy. And Nick was a fabulous owner. He gave the league great credibility because Nick owned the Cleveland Cavaliers and he owned the Cleveland Indians. And now he had been rejected by the NHL for a franchise in Cleveland, so he got ticked off, came right to the WHA, and they sold him Calgary and moved it into Cleveland, which was instant credibility for us. Nick ended up being a real good friend. He had a great saying, which I always loved. He'd always say to me and anybody who would listen, he'd say, Baldy, that's what he called me, always remember the joy is in creating and not maintaining, which says he loved starting something and getting it going, but he wasn't very good at keeping it going. The Miami franchise went to Philadelphia, and that's a fun story because we had the league meeting, and everybody at the beginning of the meeting would give their progress report. And the progress report came in from Miami, but the owner wasn't there. He just sent in an update with a photo of the arena. And you looked through the glass doors of the arena and you saw palm trees. And actually, it was Alan Eagleson that noted it. And he said so in the paper, but he said, this is not an arena being built. This is like a Hollywood movie set where it was a facade. It was like two walls. You do that when you film sometimes. And so we knew right away that there was something, quote unquote, wrong here. And then the next thing was he sent his $10,000 league dues in and the check bounced. So that was it for Miami, and off they went to Philly. But again, he did one good thing. He signed Bernie Parent, which was, you know, a big coup at the time for the league. So and there were other characters, and it was, you know, when you think you start a league in November and you start playing a year later, 10 months later, and in that first year we had four franchise shifts.
In most cases, when you think of like upstart leagues that have gone in, that was always a sign of disaster. When you see a lot of movement, they haven't even played, and they're moving. But because you guys made those moves initially, you saved yourself a lot of those problems, and it actually did the opposite of what it usually does. It actually brought stability.
Each move, you said that very well, because if you look at San Fran to Quebec, need I say more? Miami to Philly, and then the year later, it went to Vancouver. But each step of the way, it was an upgrade. And then, of course, you had Dayton to Houston, which was an upgrade. So, you know, each time there was a shift, it was a step up. And with not only a better place to play, but with a better ownership group.
You know, you mentioned Alan Eagleson before, the head of the NHL Players Union. And he must have loved what you guys were doing, because being stuck in a league that moved very slowly with salaries and so forth, to have options for these people and really to kind of fight that whole idea of the reserve clause was historical in nature because you really freed the professional hockey player.
Yes, you're so right. I mean, Allan Eagleson, on the one hand, would be critical of everybody in the NHL, was making fun of it, it's not going to work and all. But on the other hand, it did more for his constituency than any one thing that ever happened in the history of the league. It created an environment where salaries virtually almost doubled, by the most part, in year one. And Allan would use the league as a stalking horse, but he wouldn't. I think the first player he signed was with us. He signed somebody with us early on. But other than that, he just used us as a stalking horse, as many others did. But that's all fair in love and war. That's part of the battle of getting something going.
And really, what you did was kind of the same thing when the AFL took off with the NFL. You start getting those key players, and that's instant credibility. And people hear the term free agency, but really, in the early 70s, baseball didn't have it. You didn't have it the way you have it now in football and other sports. It was a real opportunity, and really, I think, took professional hockey to kind of this, really it was a regional game. You kind of took it national. You opened up, like you're talking about, you opened up these Sunbelt cities, which again, when we look at the world of hockey today, it were those moves in the 70s, why 50 years later, the sport is so powerful and so acclaimed throughout North America.
You're so right. And all one had to do is look at the existing contracts, and we'll do a show, you know, two or three episodes from now, just on the first year legal battles, and we'll kind of review each of the key, the Higginbotham decision, the decision in Boston. There was a couple of the Hull decision, a couple of key decisions, but the quickest and easiest was the one in Boston, which took 14 minutes for the judge to ratify that the WHA contracts were legal and the NHL contracts, the way they were constructed, were illegal. And that's what happens when you have a monopoly for a long period of time. It wasn't just the NHL. It was football and it was basketball. And baseball, of course, to me, most of the time they can't get out of their own way. And they've had the biggest benefit of all, which is an antitrust exemption and never the challenge of a new league. I mean, sure, you had a flurry of a couple of leagues, but it was a joke. And yet they seem to have dug the deepest hole for themselves. But that's not my area of sports economics. Hockey is more, I'm more knowledgeable on that. But I can tell you the judge in Boston took one look at the contract and said, This is, you know, binds you for life. It's a one-year contract that bound you to the team for life. So that got straightened away very quickly.
And if you hadn't won those cases, though, and I know we're going to go through those as the series goes on, but you could have gone the way of the USFL. You had to have those in order to continue.
We had to have them, of course. You're right. But it was interesting. That was one. You always had it in the back of your mind, like sort of a cloud, but it was so obvious the contracts were illegal. It was so obvious that it wasn't something that we really worried about. So that wasn't something that kept us awake. There were other things that kept us awake at night more than that.
Well, next week we're going to talk about the draft, but as you got closer to it, were you feeling good and were your partner, so to speak, in the other cities throughout the Canada and the United States, were they feeling pretty good about this as the draft was coming on? Okay, and obviously there's a lot of steps to even dropping the puck for the first time. But I guess at this point you had to feel like, well, things are going our way overall.
Well, we got into the league November of 71. We went to the meeting in February with our financing in order, with an absolute top-of-the-line GM and coach, with the start of a really good staff. Ronnie Ryan, who we'll have on, Jack Ferrara, and then in the marketing and sales. I mean, in 3 months, we did a hell of a lot. But this was the draft, I believe, was early February, mid-February. You know, we only had 6 months, 7 months to have a whole team and a whole league put together and ready to play a 78-game schedule. So, yes, we were feeling good. and we didn't have time, and we were actually, you know, we were young, so we really didn't have the fear that maybe some other people did. But, we were well on our way and obviously excited. But when we have the calls and the follow-ups with the league, that always, in the 7 years of the WHA, the biggest apprehension and fear I had was not us and our ability to succeed, but would we be let down by some of the others?
Because you're only as good as your worst franchise, in a sense, right? Because the league, you want your team to do as well as they can, but really the whole league has to be competitive or it doesn't matter.
Everybody's heard the saying, you're as strong as your weakest link. And every year we had some weak links. Every year we did. But we had enough strong links so that very quickly the NHL realized these guys aren't going away. And the other thing we'll do that'll be fun as we go on this journey telling this story, we'll talk about some of the NHL teams that got it and realized, okay, these guys are for real. If we don't get off our asses, we're going to lose key players. And some didn't get it. And the ones that didn't get it suffered for years. And the ones that did prospered.
Well, one last question for this episode. We've heard your story coming from the Flyer organization. Do you think that helped in the sense that you were at a pretty good NHL organization, not one that just had the arrogance of a long, long history, but really one of the new franchises that was successful off the top for the NHL? Was that a good situation where you kind of knew how that worked and you knew what this should look like as you were building?
I was so blessed to have my college education in professional sports early on with the Flyers organization. Ed Snyder, top of the food chain when it comes to owners and leaders. He was one of my dearest, closest friends. They included me in everything. I soaked it up like a sponge. The owners, it was Joe Scott, Bill Putnam early on, and then he left. And, of course, led by Ed Snyder. And they worked. And they innovated, they created, and have built a model franchise over the years. It's just, I don't feel there's very few that have ever been better. So I was really lucky to have that. And I paid attention and I learned so that when I had to, run the Whalers, I had enough of a background so that I knew enough to delegate properly and hopefully bring the right people in. And then tickets were the lifeblood, as we said on the show earlier. And that was my background. So I was really lucky to know what it took to sell tickets and to account for them, because that's really where the revenue streams were.
Well, this is all about building, and next week we're going to be talking about building the team through the draft. Is there anything that we should be particularly waiting for to hear about? Because I would imagine, just like everything else that was involved with the WHA, you had some big things and some scary things too.
Oh yeah, the draft was another. I mean, but the draft was huge, and we had it in the craziest place on the planet, down in Anaheim, Orange County, which was then. Certainly, they've done great now, but then it was not exactly what you'd call hockey territory.
Can't wait to hear it. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you, Howard.
All right. Thank you.